Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 257 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 28 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. I've got another great episode for you today. We're returning to our exploration of the Dungeon Master's Guide. And today we are starting on Chapter 7, Treasure. Don't know if we'll get through it all today. I'm going to try, but we'll get as far as we can get. Before we crack open the DMG, though, I want to let you know that I have recently updated my D&D supplement Relics of Power. So that's been revised and expanded. I've advanced the relics from my current D&D campaign, Hinterlands of Alandria / Blood of the Avatars, all the way up to level 7. So check that out if you haven't checked it out yet, or if you've bought it in the past, you get the update for free. So if you didn't receive an email from me letting you know that you have a new download, get a hold of me, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com, and I will hook you up. All right, well, we have a lot to discuss in the DMG today. So without further ado, let's proceed with our episode and crack open that tome of Dungeon Master Knowledge and Wisdom. All right, so today we're going to start talking about Chapter 7 of the DMG, which is Treasure. And this has always been one of my favorite parts of being a Dungeon Master or a Game Master, and that's handing out treasure or rewards to the players. And today in 5th edition D&D, we have even more options for rewards for players than we've ever had before, as well as those tried and true rewards like gold and magic items. So this chapter really does a lot, I think, to answer the question, why on earth do we adventure anyway? Why do these characters leave the safety of their homes and venture out into the wilderness and unexplored places or ancient places and fight monsters and overcome traps and brave all these dangers? Why do they do this? And a lot of the answers to that are in this chapter because of the cool things that they find, the cool rewards that they can get. So just talking about treasure, there are a few basic kinds of treasure. There are coins, you know, your copper pieces, your silver pieces, your electrum pieces, your gold pieces, your platinum pieces, and so on. Also included with this would be trade bars, if you use trade bars. And I think we talked about trade bars way back when. I think it's in maybe one of the first chapters of the book when we're talking about world building. There's some suggestion or some discussion of trade bars. And I'm a huge fan of trade bars because, you know, there comes a point when you're dealing with such a large amount of money that, you know, sacks upon sacks of gold pieces gets a little ridiculous. And you know, one very common way to deal with that is to use gems instead. I mean, you can have one gem that's worth 500 gold or more. And another great solution to that is trade bars. So trade bars just let you have more value in one object. And there's some historical verisimilitude and even current day verisimilitude to it. And, you know, if you just like the image like I do of the characters finding a stack of gold bars or even platinum bars, then trade bars are pretty cool. However, we have other types of treasure in addition to coins. Of course, we have the gemstones, which I just mentioned. And we also have art objects. So these could be idols or statues cast of solid gold, necklaces studded with precious stones, paintings of ancient kings, bejeweled dishes. Art objects include all these things and more. So, art objects doesn't just mean, quote, art, like paintings and statues and things like that. They can also be jewelry, just really anything that's worth a good amount of money that isn't coins or gemstones or magic items falls into this kind of broad category of art objects. And then we have magic items, and there's all different kinds of magic items, which a lot of this chapter is about. But really, those are our basic types of treasure in D&D. So after this explanation in this chapter, we now have treasure tables. And one thing to point out right away is there are two different basic types of treasure tables here in this book. There are the individual tables and then the hoard tables. So the individual treasure tables are to answer the question of what does this particular NPC or monster have in their pockets or on their person as far as valuables. So if we skip ahead a couple pages to page 136, we have the individual treasure tables. Now, these are by challenge rating. So we have one table for challenge 0 to 4, another one for challenge 5 to 10, another one for challenge 11 to 16, and another for challenge 17 plus. These are also lining up with the tiers of the game. So you could say we have a table for tier 1, a table for tier 2, tier 3, and tier 4. So these tables are really simple. You just roll a D100. And let's say we're rolling on the challenge 0 to 4 or the tier 1 table. Let's say maybe we've accosted a goblin and we're wondering if he has anything in his pockets. We would roll a D100. And if we rolled 1 to 30, that goblin could have 5d6 copper pieces. And the average is given in parentheses afterwards in case you don't want to take the time to roll. So that would be 17 copper if you don't want to roll. If you rolled 31 to 60, that goblin would have 4d6 silver or an average of 14 silver. If you rolled 61 to 70, the goblin would have 3d6 electrum or 10 average electrum. 71 to 95 would have 3d6 gold or 10 gold. And if you rolled 96 to 100, that goblin would actually be walking around with 1d6 or an average of 3 platinum pieces jangling around in his or her pockets. So that's pretty cool. And then as we get to the higher tiers or higher challenge rating tables, it's more the same, but you do have the possibility of getting more than one type of coin in a given roll. So for instance, let's take the tier 3 table or challenge 11 to 16. If you roll a 21 to 35 on the D100, you would find 1d6 times 100 electrum and 1d6 times 100 gold. So that's pretty cool. And that's really simply how they work. It's as easy as that. And it gives us a suggestion here to determine the total amount of individual treasure for a group of similar creatures. You can save time by rolling once and multiplying the result by the number of creatures in the group. So let's say the player characters encounter a group of 5 goblins out on the road somewhere. You could just roll once on this table and multiply it by 5 to get the total amount of treasure found for the group. And again, we're using individual treasure tables to determine treasure carried by an individual NPC or monster. And, you know, this might go without saying, but, you know, always think about verisimilitude. And, you know, some monsters just aren't going to have treasure, or, you know, you might have to think about where is that treasure located or how is that treasure found. So, for instance, you might have a given monster who doesn't have pockets to carry coins in, but maybe has some treasure in its stomach from things it's eaten in the past. And, you know, gold pieces and silver pieces probably don't digest. They're either passed out eventually or just remain in the creature's stomach. So, you know, sometimes you can find treasure within a creature if it doesn't have pockets. It also mentions here that if it doesn't make sense for a monster to carry a large pile of coins, you could convert the coins into gemstones or art objects of equal value. And that's kind of just a general rule with treasure is, you know, always feel free to convert things to another form with the same value if it makes sense. So for instance, you're not going to see trade bars on these treasure tables. So, you know, if the maybe the player characters are looting a merchant for some reason, and you rolled, maybe the merchant has a few thousand gold pieces. Well, you could convert that into gold bars, which might make sense for the merchant to have some gold bars as opposed to thousands and thousands of gold pieces or gems or art objects of some kind. Also, I should point out that you're not going to find any magic items on the individual treasure tables. So, you know, I would say if you want the PCs to find a magic item, just think about the equipment that this monster or NPC might have. Now, obviously, that's going to work better with humanoids and other monsters that actually will use weapons and things like that. But, you know, the goblin might be using a magic dagger or have some potions or whatnot. And of course, make sure and think of those during the actual encounter, because the NPC or monster might use that magic item. But as a general rule, you don't see magic items on individual tables. You're going to find those on the hoard tables. So let's talk about the treasure hoard tables. So these help you randomly determine the contents of a large cache of treasure. The accumulated wealth of a large group of creatures, such as an orc tribe or a hobgoblin army, the belongings of a single powerful creature that likes to hoard treasure, like a dragon, or the reward bestowed upon a party upon completing a quest for a benefactor. You can also split up a treasure hoard so that the adventurers don't find or receive it all at once. So there's a couple things here I just want to point out real quickly. First of all, you can use these treasure hoard tables to give you a guideline of what to give the player characters for a quest reward. So maybe you have an NPC that's going to hire your player characters to, you know, maybe guard a caravan or rescue a prince or a princess or something like that. And you're wondering, well, what kind of reward should I offer the player characters for this quest? And so you can look at the treasure hoard table for the current level of the player characters and either roll or select things from that. And that'll give you a good guideline of the value of the reward they should get, whether that's in the form of money or art objects or even magic items. The other thing here is that you can also use this for treasure, like say in a dungeon. And maybe as opposed to there being a big final boss who has all the treasure and the player characters are going to find all this treasure in the final room of the dungeon, maybe you want to spread it out more. You know, maybe there's a bunch of smaller adversaries in the dungeon instead of one big bad one at the end. So you could do your treasure hoard roll to come up with your pool of treasure and then distribute that through your dungeon however you like. So just always remember, you know, these, you know, as we always say, these tools in the DMG and other books, they're there to guide you, to get you started. They're not the limit of what you can do. As a game master, you can do whatever the hell you want. So, you know, use these tables however you want, however they can be useful to you. When determining the contents of a hoard belonging to one monster, use the table that corresponds to that monster's challenge rating. So like the individual treasure tables, the treasure hoard tables each cover a span of challenge ratings. So we have a table for challenge rating 0 to 4 or tier 1, a table for challenge 5 to 10 or tier 2, a table for 11 to 16 or tier 3, and then a table for level 17 or challenge 17 and up or tier 4. When rolling to determine a treasure hoard belonging to a large group of monsters, use the challenge rating of the monster that leads the group. Or another way to say it is the highest challenge rating monster in the group, which is what I would do, because maybe the leader isn't the highest challenge rating. So I would use the highest challenge rating monster, who may or may not be the actual leader. If the hoard belongs to no one, use the challenge rating of the monster that presides over the dungeon or lair you are stalking. If the hoard is a gift from a benefactor, for instance, as a quest reward, use the challenge rating equal to the party's average level. Every treasure hoard contains a random number of coins as shown at the top of each table. Roll a D100 and consult the table to determine how many gemstones or art objects the hoard contains, if any. Use that same roll to determine whether the hoard contains magic items. As with the individual treasure tables, average values are given in parentheses. You can use an average value instead of rolling dice to save time. So yeah, let's look at one of these. So again, we flip ahead a few pages to page 137. And let's look at, for instance, our tier 2 treasure hoard table for challenges 5 to 10. So to use this table, we would just roll percentile dice or a D100. And we would take that number. Let's say we roll 76. And we would use that to find out if we get any art objects or gems. So for instance, on this table, a roll of 76 on the D100 gives us 2D4 or an average of 5, 25 gold piece art objects. And then we are told to roll once on magic item table D. So that's how we figure out the gems and or art objects and or magic items. And then again, at the very top of this table is our coins. So we see on the challenge 5 to 10 table, we roll 2d6 times it by 100, and that's how many copper pieces are in the hoard, or for an average of 700. 2d6 times 1,000 silver pieces for an average of 7,000 silver pieces, no electrum, 6d6 times 100 gold pieces, or an average of 2,100, and 3d6 times 10 platinum pieces for an average of 105. And again, these coins, you know, this is just giving you the value so you can change the form that treasure takes to fit what would make sense for the given treasure. So maybe you don't want to give the PC 700 copper and you convert that to 70 silver or 7 gold or 7 gold worth of gems. So, you know, that's all kind of set dressing. Really, the only thing that's important as far as, quote, game balance as it is the value. So what form that takes doesn't really matter. If a treasure hoard seems too small, you can roll multiple times on the table. Use this approach for monsters that are particularly fond of amassing treasure. Legendary creatures that accumulate treasure are wealthier than normal. Always roll at least twice on the appropriate table and add the results together. So, you know, this is something that's kind of a little buried in here and you might miss or forget about. So anytime you're dealing with a legendary creature, this is telling you that you want to roll at least twice on the given table for that creature. So if we're talking about a legendary creature that's somewhere between challenge rating 5 and 10, then we're actually going to roll on this challenge 5 to 10 treasure hoard table at least twice for that legendary creature. And then it also suggests here that you may also roll multiple times for creatures that are known for amassing treasure. For instance, a dragon. So personally, if I'm thinking about a dragon, first of all, if it's legendary, that's at least two rolls on the table, and it should get at least one other roll on the table because it's dragon. So if you're talking a legendary dragon, you're probably talking at least three rolls on the treasure table, if not more. And again, that's up to you as the GM to decide how far you want to go with that. It then goes on to say you can hand out as much or as little treasure as you want. And then we're given some guidelines for, you know, what the folks at Wizards think an average amount of treasure would be in a campaign. So over the course of a typical campaign, a party finds treasure hoards amounting to 7 rolls on the challenge 0 to 4 table, 18 rolls on the challenge 5 to 10 table, and 12 rolls on the challenge 11 to 16 table, with a remaining 8 rolls on the challenge 17 plus table. And of course, I will point out again, you don't have to be a slave to the dice. So when you're rolling on these tables, you can always choose a result, especially when we get to rolling on the magic item tables. A lot of times you're going to want to choose a magic item from the relevant table as opposed to just rolling. Depends on the treasure, of course, and what you're trying to do. But sometimes just rolling random magic items isn't going to be very satisfying for you or the player characters. You're going to want to select items that either makes sense that they would be a part of that treasure hoard, or that that monster would have them, or items that the player characters need or can use, or items that will become useful later in the campaign, things like that. Next, we have some tables of gemstones. So gemstones are broken down based on value, and we have a table for each value of stone with different types of stones that fit that category. So we have 10 gold piece gemstones, 50 gold piece gemstones, 100 gold piece gemstones, 500 gold piece gems, 1,000 gold piece gems, and 5,000 gold piece gems. So, for example, on our 5,000 gold piece gem table, there are four of them. We have black, sapphire, diamond, jacinth, and ruby. And it also, in parentheses, gives a description of each of these, which is really nice because if you're like me, you're going to see stones in here that you don't recognize and don't necessarily know what they look like. I'll point out that another very handy tool here is just a Google image search. So if you want to hand out one of these stones, Google image search will provide you with many, many images of what those stones look like, which can be really nice visual aids for your player characters as well. As they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. So you could describe this exotic stone, or you could just show them a picture of one. You might even find a picture of a necklace or something that could be the actual art object that they find, which would be super cool. Next, we have tables of art objects, and like the gems, they are put in different tables based on their value. So we have art object tables for 25 gold, 250 gold, 750 gold, 2,500 gold, and then 7,500 gold or 7,500 gold piece art objects. So if you're wondering what 7,500 gold piece art objects look like, examples we're given are a jeweled gold crown, a jeweled platinum ring, a small gold statue set with rubies, a gold cup set with emeralds, and so on. And each of these tables for the art objects at the different values have example art objects. And again, those are just examples just to get you started. You can come up with countless more. And, you know, the cool thing about art objects is they can kind of have any value under the sun, depending on the materials they're made of and the craftsmanship involved. So, for instance, you might have a little statuette that's carved of wood, but it's done with such artistry that it's worth quite a bit of money. Or you might have another little statuette that maybe isn't carved so well or isn't shaped so well, but it's made out of solid gold or platinum, and because of that, it's worth a lot of money. So there's a lot of leeway and wiggle room and room for creativity here from you as a GM as far as what form these art objects take, what they're worth, what they're made of, all that kind of stuff. And something I want to point out to you that we talked about way back when, I think when in one of the player's handbook discussions, but the coins, things like your trade bars, your gemstones, and your art objects, also trade goods, which isn't discussed here. It's discussed in the player's handbook, but trade goods are really mundane things like salt, flour, stuff like that, iron ingots, things like that. All of those things can be traded or used to pay for things at face value, and they're just considered another form of currency. So, for instance, if your player character wants to buy a suit of armor, yeah, you can pay for that with gold pieces or silver pieces or whatever, but you could also pay for that suit of armor with an art object or with gems or with trade bars or with any combination of those, as long as the value comes out correctly. Now, that's just a general rule to keep all our lives simple. But of course, you know, you can bring that into your setting as much as you want and make that make sense as much as you want. So for instance, if you're dealing with an armor smith who's going to craft you a suit of plate armor, you know, that armor smith might happily take payments in the form of trade bars or gems, or perhaps particular art objects, for instance, maybe things made of gold or silver or platinum that if nothing else, he could melt down and use for something. But you know, the armorsmith may not have much use for your really nice painting you found in the last dungeon. So as a DM, you know, you can always say that a given NPC won't take certain forms of payment, but as a general rule in D&D, trade bars are objects, gems, and even trade goods can be used in place of currency, and the player characters can just buy things with those. They don't have to go sell the art object for gold and then use the gold to buy something. They can just buy something with the art object. And really, I think that's just to simplify things and keep the focus on the game on things other than money changing and trading and things like that. But if your group enjoys those kinds of things, then you can get into the more nitty gritty of, oh, well, the armorsmith isn't going to take this painting as payment, so I have to find an art dealer to buy it from me, and then I can pay the armorsmith. So that's really up to you as a GM and what your players like, you know, how deep you want to go into that kind of realism. All right, so that's kind of our discussion of mundane treasure in here. And now we get into what the bulk of this chapter is about, which is magic items. And here we have a discussion of magic item rarity. So this always reminds me of Magic the Gathering magic cards, also produced by Wizards of the Coast. And you have different rarities of magic cards, and it's the exact same thing with magic items. We're using a slightly different terms here, but it's the exact same idea. So we have common magic items, uncommon, rare, very rare, and legendary. So your common magic items, there aren't a lot of them in the game. There are more with, I believe it's Xanathar's Guide that added a bunch more common items to the game. But if you're just talking the Player's Handbook and the DMG, your common magic items are things like, I believe, potions of healing, potions of climbing, and some low-level spell scrolls. Like, I think just first and second level spell scrolls are common items. And that's kind of it, which makes sense. I mean, magic items shouldn't be that common. And then we have our uncommon items, rare, very rare, and legendary. And here we have our magic item rarity table, which is very helpful and useful and something you'll want to be able to find quickly. Because you're going to use this a lot as a GM. So one thing that's really helpful here is the character level. So it gives you here a guide of when characters should find these different magic items. So for instance, common magic items will usually be found by characters first level or higher. And the same with uncommon items. So if you're running a first level adventure or you're designing a first level adventure, and you're wondering what kind of treasure to put in it, well, as far as magic items, you're probably just going to want to have common and uncommon magic items. Then our next level of power is rare items, which are found at fifth level and higher. So once your player characters are fifth level, you can start sprinkling in some rare items. Very rare items are found at 11th level or higher. And legendary items are found at 17th level or higher. And again, these map directly to the tiers of the game. So another way to say this is uncommon and common items are found at tier 1 or higher. Rare items are found at tier 2 or higher. Very rare items are found at tier 3 or higher. And legendary items are found at tier 4. The other thing that's useful on this table is a range of values for the items. And this comes in handy if player characters are going to buy, sell, or even craft these items. These values will come in handy. So a common item, it's suggested, could be worth anything from 50 to 100 gold. An uncommon item, anything from 101 to 500 gold. A rare item can be worth anything from 501 to 5,000 gold. A very rare item can be worth anything from 5,001 gold to 50,000 gold. And a legendary item can be worth anything from 50,001 gold and up. So yeah, they get pretty expensive. Here we have a brief discussion of buying and selling magic items. Unless you decide your campaign works otherwise, most magic items are so rare that they aren't available for purchase. Common items, such as potions of healing, can be procured from an alchemist, herbalist, or spellcaster. Doing so is rarely as simple as walking into a shop and selecting an item from a shelf, though. The seller might ask for a service rather than coin. So there you go. There's a possible adventure hook for you if you need one. Even a common item like a potion of healing might require a deed to be done or a favor to be done as opposed to just paying gold for it. And that could be in addition to paying gold for it. In a large city with an academy of magic or a major temple, buying and selling magic items might be possible at your discretion. If your world includes a large number of adventurers engaged in retrieving ancient magic items, trading these items might be more common. Even so, it's likely to remain similar to the market for fine art in the real world, with invitation-only auctions and a tendency to attract thieves. Selling magic items is difficult in most D&D worlds, primarily because of the challenge of finding a buyer. Plenty of people might like to have a magic sword, but few of them can really afford it. Those who can afford such an item usually have more practical things to spend their money on. And then it says, see chapter 6 for one way to handle selling magic items, which we just discussed in the last episode, downtime activities. In your campaign, magic items might be prevalent enough that adventurers can buy and sell them. Magic items might be for sale in bazaars or auction houses in fantastical locations, such as the City of Brass, the planar metropolis of Sigil, or in more ordinary cities. Sale of magic items might be regulated, accompanied by a thriving black market. Artificers might craft items for use by military forces or adventurers, as they do in the world of Eberron. You might also allow characters to craft their own magic items, as discussed in the previous chapter. So yeah, there's a lot of ways you can go there. You know, the default assumption in most D&D settings is that magic items, as a rule, can't be bought and or sold. But of course, you can do what you want. So in my D&D games and in my homebrew world of Primordia, I do have some buying and selling of magic items because I have a guild of adventurers who, you know, their whole thing is sending adventuring teams out to explore ruins and things like that. And one of the main things they're doing is looking for magic items from the past, looking for spells and magical knowledge from the past and things like that. So it only makes sense if you have an organization of adventurers and they're finding all these magic items that they're occasionally going to find magic items that they don't have a particular use for, but another adventurer in the organization might. So I have a guild quartermaster who is an NPC who basically buys and sells magic items. So this NPC will buy magic items from adventuring teams that they don't want or need, and then will sell those to other adventurers in the guild. Now, this is something that only exists as part of the guild. There, you know, in my city of Alandria, there aren't magic item shops per se. So really the only way to buy and sell magic items is through the guild. However, I really like the suggestion here that there are places where this does happen, and specifically the City of Brass, which is on the Plain of Fire. And I really like that suggestion because, well, first of all, that's not going to be relevant in lower leveled campaigns. Player characters are going to have access to some kind of a gate or portal or something like that, or higher level spells that enable them to plane travel, like astral travel or plane shift or something like that. So going to a magic item shop in the City of Brass isn't even going to be a possibility at the lower levels of the game. So by the time the player characters have the means to reach the City of Brass and survive it in order to buy and sell magic items, A, they're going to probably have enough treasure to be able to do that and be able to afford it. And B, they're going to be powerful enough that as a dungeon master, I'm not super concerned about them able to buy a ring of protection or being able to sell magic items that they found that they don't want or can't use. So it's a really elegant solution, I think, because it kind of puts that off to a point in the campaign where it's going to be okay for the players to have access to that. And at lower levels, when you don't want them to have access to that, they won't. And the other thing I really like about it is it's a reason to go to the Plane of Fire. It's a hook into all kinds of possible adventures that you could have on the Plane of Fire and getting there and getting back from the Plane of Fire in the City of Brass. So I really dig stuff like that. Next, we have discussion on identifying a magic item. Now, this is something that's changed a lot in 5th edition from previous versions of the game. And I really dig the changes. And again, you know, we're not letting ourselves get bogged down in things that we don't really care about, like spending a ton of time figuring out what a magic item does, we can just get on with the story and get back to the fun stuff. So some magic items are indistinguishable from their non-magical counterparts, whereas other magic items are conspicuously magical. And that's something to keep in mind, and you know, I do this a lot in my games, is in the world of Primordia, a lot of times magic items are pretty obvious. They tend to be works of art in their own right, made by master craftsmen. So if you're talking about a magical sword, it doesn't just look like an average sword. It looks like a sword that was made by a master swordsmith. It probably has some fancy engraving and or gems or whatever. So magic items, at least in my D&D game, are usually pretty obvious. And a lot of times I will tell players, hey, this looks like it's probably a magic item, and they don't even have to detect magic or whatever. Now, they can cast detect magic to be sure, because just because it looks like it could be a magic item doesn't mean it is. And that doesn't tell you what it can do. But a lot of times it's obvious, but then sometimes it may not be, depending on item. So that's something to keep in mind, you know, just as a general rule in your game or for exceptions. You know, does this particular item appear to be obviously magical, or is it going to take some investigation to figure out if it's magical or not? Whatever a magic item's appearance, though, handling the item is usually enough to give a player or a character a sense that something is extraordinary about it. Discovering a magic item's properties isn't automatic, however. The identify spell is the fastest way to reveal an item's properties. Alternatively, a character can focus on one magic item during a short rest while being in physical contact with the item. At the end of the rest, the character learns the item's properties as well as how to use them. Potions are an exception. A little taste is enough to tell the taster what the potion does. Sometimes a magic item carries a clue to its properties. The command word to activate a ring might be etched in tiny letters inside it, or a feathered design might suggest that it's a ring of falling. Ring of falling, that'd be a great magic item, right? It sounds like a cursed item to me. Maybe that's a cursed item that appears as a ring of falling, but actually makes you take more falling damage instead of less or none. Wearing or experimenting with an item can also offer hints about its properties. For example, if a character puts on a ring of jumping, you could say, "Your steps feel strangely springy." Perhaps the character then jumps up and down to see what happens. You then say the character jumps unexpectedly high. And then we have a variant here of more difficult identification. If you prefer magic items to have a greater mystique, consider removing the ability to identify the properties of a magic item during a short rest and require the identify spell, experimentation, or both to reveal what a magic item does. And again, this is something, you know, you can do as an exception. So maybe in your world, you know, for the most part, identifying magic items is easy as described, but you may have a specific item that is an exception and requires the identify spell or requires experimentation or both. Next, we have attunement. Now, this is something new with 5th edition, the idea of attuning magic items. So various editions have had various ways of setting some kind of a limit on how much magic a character can have. So 5th edition just uses the attunement system, which says that you can only have 3 attuned items at a time. Some magic items require a creature to form a bond with them before their magical properties can be used. This bond is called attunement, and certain items have a prerequisite for it. If the prerequisite is a class, a creature must be a member of that class to attune to the item. If the class is a spellcasting class, a monster qualifies for it if it has spell slots and uses the class's spell list. If the prerequisite is to be a spellcaster, a creature qualifies if it can cast at least one spell using its traits or features, not using a magic item or the like. Without becoming attuned to an item that requires attunement, a creature gains only its non-magical benefits unless its description states otherwise. For example, a magic shield that requires attunement provides the benefits of a normal shield to a creature not attuned to it, but none of its magical properties. Attuning to an item requires a creature to spend a short rest focused on only that item while being in physical contact with it. This cannot be the same short rest used to learn the item's properties. So if you find a new item and you want to identify it and attune to it, you're talking two short rests or 2 hours to do that. This focus can take the form of a weapon practice for a weapon, meditation for a wondrous item, or some other appropriate activity. If the short rest is interrupted, the attunement attempt fails. Otherwise, at the end of the short rest, the creature gains an intuitive understanding of how to activate any magical properties of the item, including any necessary command words. An item can be attuned to only one creature at a time, and a creature can be attuned to no more than 3 magic items at a time. Any attempt to attune to a 4th item fails. The creature must end its attunement to an item first. Additionally, a creature can't attune to more than 1 copy of an item. For example, a creature can't attune to more than 1 ring of protection at a time. A creature's attunement to an item ends if the creature no longer satisfies their prerequisites for attunement. So, yeah, that seems pretty niche, but I guess that could happen. I think one possibility there could be alignment. So there aren't many, but there are some items that have an alignment requirement. So, for instance, I think a Moonblade requires a good alignment. So if your character goes full evil, you may not be attuned to your Moonblade anymore. Attunement can also end if the item has been more than 100 feet away from the character for at least 24 hours, if the character dies, or if another creature attunes to the item. A creature can also voluntarily end attunement by spending another short rest focused on the item, unless the item is cursed. So cursed items then. Some magic items bear curses that bedevil their users. If sometimes long after a user has stopped using an item, a magic item's description specifies whether the item is cursed. Most methods of identifying items, including the identify spell, fail to reveal such a curse, although lore might hint at it. A curse should be a surprise to the item's user when the curse's effects are revealed. Attunement to a curse item can't be ended voluntarily, otherwise what would be the point, unless the curse is broken first, such as with the remove curse spell. All right, awesome. So yeah, you know, that's how magic identification works and how cursed item works by default. And of course, you know, you can do things differently if you want. All right, so next we get into the magic items themselves. And there are oodles and oodles of magic items in here. And in fact, the majority of this chapter is descriptions of magic items. So just a couple things I want to point out here that I think are super cool are some of our variant possibilities here. So on page 140, we have a variant of mixing potions, which sounds like fun to me. A character might drink one potion while still under the effects of another, or pour several potions into a single container. The strange ingredients used in creating potions can result in unpredictable interactions. When a character mixes 2 potions together, you can roll on the potion miscibility table. If more than 2 are combined, roll again for each subsequent potion, combining the results. Unless the effects are immediately obvious, reveal them only when they become evident. So on this table, some of the results are the mixture creates a magical explosion, dealing force damage to each creature within 5 feet. The mixture could become an ingested poison of the DM's choice. Both potions could lose their effects. One potion could lose its effects. Both potions could work, but with their numerical effects and durations halved. A potion has no effect if it can't be halved in this way. Both potions could work normally. The numerical effects and duration of one potion are doubled. If neither potion has anything to double in this way, they work normally. And then if you roll a 100 on the D100, only one potion works, but its effect is permanent. Choose the simplest effect to make permanent or the one that seems the most fun. For example, a potion of healing might increase the drinker's hit point maximum by 4, or oil of etherealness might permanently trap the user in the ethereal plane. At your discretion, an appropriate spell, such as dispel magic or remove curse, might end this lasting effect. So that's really fun, you know, and this is probably pretty niche. In all the years running 5th edition D&D, I don't think I've had a character try to mix potions yet, but if you have someone try this, this is pretty fun because there's a good chance they won't get anything good out of it. They might just waste the potions. There's a chance something bad could happen, and there's a chance that something fairly cool could happen. So I like that kind of stuff. Add some interesting possibilities to the game. Another variant system we have here, and you know, these are optional, of course. You get to decide as the GM if you want to use these or not, is scroll mishaps. A creature who tries and fails to cast a spell from a spell scroll must make a DC 10 intelligence saving throw. If the saving throw fails, roll on the mishap table. So mishaps include a surge of magical energy that deals damage to the caster. The spell affects the caster or an ally instead of the intended target. The spell affects a random location within the range. The spell's effect is contrary to its normal one, but neither harmful nor beneficial. For instance, a fireball might produce an area of harmless cold. The caster suffers a minor but bizarre effect related to the spell. For example, a fireball might cause smoke to billow from the caster's ears for 1d10 minutes. That's kind of fun. Another possibility is a spell activates after 1d12 hours. If the caster was the intended target, the spell takes effect normally. If the caster was not the intended target, the spell goes off in the general direction of the intended target up to the spell's maximum range if the target has moved away. So yeah, that can be fun. Again, pretty niche, but you could have some fun with that if it comes up. Another possibility here given for some treasure you might find is a magic item formula. So this is basically directions on how to make a particular magic item. So if you're going to allow your player characters to create magic items or craft magic items, keep in mind that they need a formula to do that. So you can have actually complete control over what items they can make by which formulas you give them access to. So one of the ways they could get these formulas is finding them in a treasure. Another variant we have here is wands that don't recharge. So a typical wand has expendable charges. So, you know, you use the charges up and then they have a recharge usually every day where you roll to see how many charges they get back. However, if you'd like wands to be a limited resource, you can make some of them incapable of regaining charges. Consider increasing the base number of charges in such a wand to a maximum of 25 charges. These charges are never regained once they're expended. And this is how I remember wands working in previous editions, like second edition, where they would have a lot more charges than they do in fifth edition. But once they were gone, they were gone. So that's a variant rule now. And, you know, you can do it that way if you prefer. Next, we have some really great tables, special features that you can add to magic items. And we've got quite a few tables here. You can use as many of these as you want with a given item. And they're just ways to give items some more mystique and some more details and some more interesting flavor. And these are really great to use with items that give some kind of mechanical benefit, but are otherwise pretty boring, like a plus one sword or plus one armor, things like that. I love to give some of these other traits to make them a little more interesting. So we have a table on who created the item or who was intended to use it. And so you can roll or choose something from this table to get a result, anything from aberrations to humans, to dragons, drow, dwarves, elves, fae, fiends. So these are all kind of types of creatures. And then each will have some kind of effect on the item. So for instance, an item crafted by a celestial or created to be used by a celestial is half the normal weight and inscribed with feathered wings, suns, and other symbols of good. Fiends find the item's presence repulsive. On the other hand, an item created by a dragon or for a dragon is made from scales and talons shed by a dragon. Perhaps it incorporates precious metals and gems from the dragon's hoard, and it grows slightly warm when within 120 feet of a dragon. So this is just one way to flesh out an item, is thinking about either who crafted it or who was it created for. Our next table is, what is a detail from the item's history? So we have eight different possibilities here. One could be arcane. This item was created for an ancient order of spellcasters and bears the order symbol. One could be sinister. This item is linked to a deed of great evil, such as a massacre or an assassination. It might have a name or be closely associated with a villain who used it. Anyone familiar with the item's history is likely to treat it and its owner with suspicion. Next, we have a table of minor properties. These are all kinds of things, and I love these. These are a great way to flesh out an item. One of my favorites is gleaming. This item never gets dirty. So in my world, a lot of magic cloaks and other items of clothing have this property. A lot of magic armors have this property. Guardian property. The item whispers warnings to its bearer, granting a +2 bonus to initiative if the bearer isn't incapacitated. A lot of great stuff here. Next, we have a table of quirks. A lot of these are kind of role-playing things. For instance, confident, the item helps its bearer feel self-assured. So this is something that the player will have to role-play. Doesn't really have a mechanical impact. Painful, the bearer experiences a harmless flash of pain when using the item. And yeah, so those can really help you flesh out an item. And of course, you can expand these tables, come up with more examples of these things, and even come up with different types of traits these items might have. This is really just to get you started. And next we have our random magic item tables. Now, these tables are really useful, not only for generating treasures randomly, but also just to help you choose appropriate treasure for the level of your player characters or the challenge rating of what they've just defeated. So again, you know, when you're looking at the hoard treasure tables, and it's suggesting that you roll on a given magic item table, you can always just choose an item from that table instead, and it will be of the appropriate kind of power level because it's coming from the same table. But you can pick something that either fits your campaign well, maybe it's something the player characters will need in the future, or maybe it's something that just really fits the character. You know, something to keep in mind is, where is this coming from? You know, if you're talking about the horde of a dragon, then it makes sense that they maybe find some random things that they can't necessarily use or whatnot. But if this treasure is the reward for a quest or something, then it makes sense that it would be something the player character could use. So, you know, nothing's quite the drag of, you know, finding a treasure hoard and you find this awesome two-handed sword, but nobody in the party uses a two-handed sword. Everybody uses rapiers, and so no one can use this awesome magic item. So it's something to think about. How much do you care about kind of believability versus how much do you want this treasure to be relevant to the player characters? And this is where, if you do have magic item buying and selling and or trading in your world, this is where that can come in, because then you can feel more free to just give out random magic items. And if it's something no one wants or can use, they can always trade it for something else they can. So it's, as always, up to you as a GM how you want to handle that. So when you look at these tables, you'll see some differences, and you can tell from the treasure hoard table that, you know, tables of higher letters tend to have more powerful items than tables of lower letters. So magic item table A is, for the most part, consumable items or common magic items, things like potions of healings, cantrip first or second level spell scrolls, bags of holding, drift globes, things like that. Magic item table B, now we're into permanent items, but they're still relatively low powered permanent items, like a piece of ammunition +1. We've also got a lot of potions and consumables here, oils, mithril armor, things like that. Magic item table C, here we've got some consumables as well as some slightly more powerful permanent item, chime of opening, things like that. And then we just go on. We've got table D, which is mostly consumables, but more powerful consumables, by which I mean potions and scrolls and oils. Table E, even more powerful consumables. And then table F, we're getting into our uncommon, I think, and maybe some rare permanent items like plus one weapons, plus one shields, things like that. Table G, and we're just going getting more and more powerful items. So you can look at these and again, cross-reference with the treasure hoard table to see what are appropriate items to choose. So for instance, let's say your player characters are tier 2, level 5 to 10. We see here on the treasure hoard table for challenge 5 to 10, we could be rolling on magic item table A, B, C, D, F, G, or H. However, we're only rolling on table H if we roll a 99 or 100 on the D100. So that's pretty rare. So that tells you that, you know, magic item table H, yeah, you could find some of those items at levels 5 to 10, but you're probably more likely going to find them at level 11 and up. So again, you can use this kind of stuff to kind of guide you, even if you're not rolling on the tables, as far as what kind of treasure you want to hand out to your player characters. All right, so following that, we have tons and tons of magic items described. So you can check that out. If there's any items you have questions about or you'd like to hear me talk about, let me know. But for now, we're going to skip all that and move on to our next big section, which is sentient magic items. So these are magic items that are sentient. They have intelligence. They have personality. They are characters in their own right. And, you know, this is something that I think maybe sometimes is overlooked. If you're wanting an NPC with your player characters for some reason, depending on what that reason is, sometimes a sentient magic item is just the thing. So I'm sure unless you're brand new to role-playing games, you've probably heard discussion of the dreaded DMPC or GMPC, where the DM has their own player character in the group. And they're not an NPC. They're an actual player character that adventures with the group and gets an equal share of XP and treasure and all that. And it's kind of a lot of times it's a DM who really wants to be a player, or at least wants to be a player too. And that can lead to all kinds of problems and headaches. And that's a whole nother discussion. But, you know, sometimes you want to have an NPC with a party, not because you want a DMPC, not because you want to be a player too, but be for other reasons. Maybe you want a way to get some information to the player characters when they need it. Maybe they need some backup. Maybe they need some more healing or something like that. Maybe they're missing a role in the party. Or what's most often the case for me personally, the reason I often want an NPC with the player characters is just so I have a way to role play with them in situations where they're not in town or they're not around other people. For instance, if they're in the middle of a dungeon or if they're camped in a wilderness somewhere, you know, it's for me as a DM, it's nice to always have a way to role play with the player characters, no matter what's going on. And the easiest way to always have that available is to have an NPC with the party. But not only can you run into trouble with all the issues with having a DMPC, if you have an NPC with a party, they can also just cause some headache just because, you know, anytime there's a combat or a social interaction or something like that, you have to worry about, well, what's the NPC doing? You have another turn to deal with. You know, if it's a combat, they're going to be doing something during the combat. So what I've found to be a fantastic solution a lot of times, if I just want to have a personality with the party to role play with them when I need it, a sentient magic item is perfect for that. Because it is a personality. It's something I can use to role play with the player characters. I can use it to give them information if I need to, or just something for them to bounce ideas off of, or just a way to interact with them when there's no one else around. However, unlike an actual NPC character, they're not so much expected to have a role in every combat or have an initiative turn in combat. And, you know, a lot of times they can take the backseat. If I don't want the magic sword to have anything to say this game session, it doesn't have to, and it's not going to be
as jarring or like what happened to this person as if they had an NPC with them who for a whole game session has nothing to say. So I've just found in all my years of running games that nobody seems to think twice when a magic item doesn't have anything to say for a long time and then suddenly does. It doesn't break verisimilitude nearly as much as the same thing happening with an NPC. So if you're like me and you like to have just kind of an ace in the hole character you can role play with the player characters at any time when there's no one else around, a sentient item is perfect for that. So here we have guidance on creating sentient magic items. So they have some things going on above and beyond what all magic items have. So they have abilities. They have intelligence, wisdom, and charisma. So you can choose these or roll them randomly or however you want to determine what those are. A sentient magic item also has a communication aspect to it. So there are different ways they can communicate. They can communicate by just transmitting emotion. So they may not be able to communicate in words, but can send feelings to the person attuned to them. Or they can speak, read, and understand one or more languages. Or they can speak, read, and understand one or more languages. And in addition to that, can communicate telepathically with any character that carries or wields it, or even with other characters. Intelligent items also have senses. They can have hearing and normal vision out to 30 feet, 60 feet, or 120 feet, or they could have hearing and dark vision out to 120 feet. And of course, you could come up with other possibilities too. Sentient items also have an alignment. And the item may or may not care to lesser or more degree about the character's alignment matching the item's alignment. And, you know, this is going to have a lot to do with how much or how little you use alignment in your game and how you use it. But there's a tool you can use there. Also, the item can have characteristics just like a player character does, which is to say personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws. Also, a sentient item can have a special purpose. And we have quite a few, actually 10 examples given here. It could be aligned. It could seek to defeat or destroy those of the opposite alignment. It could be a bane item made to defeat or destroy creatures of a certain type, like fiends, trolls, wizards, whatever. And yeah, we've got some other possibilities here. So this is basically, why was this item created? Or what is this item's purpose? What is it trying to accomplish? We have here a system for conflict. So the thing, or one of the things that's cool about a sentient item is it has a will of its own. It has its own things that it wants to do and accomplish. And if it's not happy with what its wielder is doing, it can actually try to force its will on it. And this involves opposed roles, using the magic item's abilities, its wisdom, charisma, intelligence versus the player characters. And yeah, you could check that out. But it's possible that the item can actually force the player character to do what it wants if it's successful in one of these conflicts. And then we're given some example sentient items. Black Razor, which is a great sword. The Moonblade, which is an elven longsword. I really love Moonblades. They're super cool, and there's a lot you could do with them. Wave and Whelm, which are another two sentient items. And Black Razor, Wave and Whelm are all found in I was just going to say which adventure, but I guess I better not. I don't want to spoil it. But they're all found in an adventure that's been released for 5th edition. That's an old school adventure from back in the day. All right, next we have a section on artifacts. And as powerful as sentient items are, artifacts are even more powerful. And of course, artifacts can be sentient too. So artifacts are kind of there's a lot that could be said about artifacts. And this article is already going long. So, you know, I think this is something that maybe we could return to later in more detail if people would want a more in-depth discussion of artifacts. But we'll hit some highlights here. So each artifact has its own magical properties, as other magic items do, and the properties are often exceptionally powerful. An artifact might have other properties that are either beneficial or detrimental. So in a nutshell, artifacts are beyond legendary in power. However, artifacts almost always, if not always, are kind of a mixed bag. So they have some really powerful abilities that are going to be very helpful to the player character wielding them. But a lot of times they have some downsides too. And kind of the idea with artifacts is they're so powerful, you can't really use them safely. So there's usually some kind of drawback to an artifact. Sometimes there's a lot of drawbacks. So you can choose properties from the tables in this section or determine them randomly. You can also invent new beneficial and detrimental properties. These properties typically change each time an artifact appears in the world. So you could have a given artifact, like let's just take the Eye of Vecna, for instance, will have certain properties that it always has, but then it has others that vary depending on when it appears and who's using it. So you never really know what an artifact can do. So we have minor beneficial properties. For instance, while attuned to the artifact, you gain proficiency in one skill of the DM's choice, or you're immune to disease, or you can't be charmed or frightened, things like that. We have major beneficial properties. For instance, while attuned to the artifact, one of your ability scores, DM's choice, increases by 2 to a maximum of 24. Or while attuned to the artifact, you regain 1d6 hit points at the start of your turn if you have at least one hit point, things like that. We also have minor detrimental properties. While attuned to the artifact, you have disadvantage on saving throws against spells, or your appearance changes as the DM decides, or your weight drops, or you can't smell, all kinds of weird things. We have major detrimental properties. While you are attuned to the artifact, your body rots over the course of 4 days, after which the rotting stops. You lose your hair by the end of day 1, fingertips and toe tips by the end of day 2, lips and nose by the end of day 3, and ears by the end of day 4. A regenerate spell restores lost body parts. When you become attuned to the artifact, you gain a form of long-term madness. I mean, some of these are pretty bad. So, yeah. There's all kinds of them you can check out. We have a discussion on destroying artifacts. And just in a nutshell, it's either impossible to do or really difficult to do and usually requires very specific things to be done. And just figuring out how to destroy an artifact can be an adventure in and of itself and then actually doing it. Cliched example of this is the One Ring from Lord of the Rings. You know, that was an artifact that had a very specific way it had to be destroyed. And then we're given some sample artifacts. We've got the Axe of the Dwarvish Lords, Book of Exalted Deeds, Book of Vile Darkness, Eye and Hand of Vecna, Orb of Dragonkind, Sword of Kas, however you want to say that, Wand of Orcus, and yeah. And you'll see each of these, for instance, the Axe of the Dwarvish Lords. We have all the things this thing can do, but this does not include the minor and or major beneficial properties and or the minor and major detrimental properties. So if you're going to use the Axe of the Dwarvish Lords in your game, not only does it do everything under Axe of Dwarvish Lords, but you can also add these other properties to it as well. So just to give you kind of an idea of what we're talking about here, let's look at the Axe of Dwarvish Lords. It's a magic weapon. It grants a +3 bonus to attack and damage. So right there, we're at legendary level, just the fact that it's a +3 weapon. It also functions as a belt of dwarven kind, a dwarven thrower, and a sword of sharpness. So it does all those things. So already this thing is like 4 magic items combined into 1. So it has the following randomly determined properties. So it's going to have 2 minor beneficial properties, 1 major beneficial property, and 2 minor detrimental properties. So the DM comes up with those from the tables we just talked about. Blessings of Morden. If you are a dwarf attuned to the axe, you gain the following benefits. You have immunity to poison damage. your dark vision increases to 60-foot range, and you gain proficiency with artisan's tools related to blacksmithing, brewing, and stonemasonry. If you are holding the axe, you can use your action to cast Conjure Elemental spell from it, summoning an Earth Elemental. You can do that once per day. Travel the Depths, you can use an action to touch the axe to a fixed piece of dwarven stonework and cast a Teleport spell from the axe. If your intended destination is underground, there's no chance of a mishap or arriving somewhere unexpected. So you can use that every 3 days. It has a curse that affects any non-dwarf who becomes attuned to it. And this curse remains even if the attunement ends. With each passing day, the creature's physical appearance and stature becomes more dwarf-like. After 7 days, the creature looks like a typical dwarf, but the creature neither loses its racial traits nor gains the racial traits of a dwarf. The physical changes wrought by the axe aren't considered magical in nature and therefore can't be dispelled, but they can be undone by any effect that removes the curse, such as Greater Restoration or Remove Curse spell. And then we're told how to destroy the axe. The only way to destroy the axe is to melt it down in the Earth Heart Forge where it was created. It must remain in the Burning Forge for 50 years before it finally succumbs to the fire and is consumed. So yeah, that's just one example of an artifact. So you can see there's a lot going on with just this one item. So finally, rounding out Chapter 7 Treasure, we have other rewards. So there are other ways you can reward the player characters other than just money and magic items. So the first types of these rewards are supernatural gifts. A supernatural gift is a special reward granted by a being or force of great magical power. Such supernatural gifts come in two forms, blessings and charms. A blessing is usually bestowed by a god or a godlike being. A charm is typically the work of a powerful spirit, a location of ancient magic, or a creature that has legendary actions. Unlike a magic item, a supernatural gift isn't an object and doesn't require attunement. It gives a character an extraordinary ability which can be used one or more times. So first we'll talk about blessings. So again, a blessing is usually given by a god or godlike being. So a character might receive a blessing from a deity for doing something truly momentous, an accomplishment that catches the attention of both gods and mortals. Killing rampaging gnolls rarely warrants such a blessing, but slaying the High Priest of Tiamat as he attempts to summon the Dragon Queen might. A blessing is an appropriate reward for one of the following accomplishments: restoring the most sacred shrine of a god, foiling an earth-shaking plot by the enemies of a god, or helping a god's favored servant complete a holy quest. An adventurer might also receive a blessing in advance of a perilous quest. For example, a paladin could receive one before setting out on a quest to slay a terrifying lich that is responsible for a magical plague sweeping the land. A character should only receive a blessing that is useful to him or her, and some blessings come with expectations on the part of the benefactor. A god typically gives a blessing for a particular purpose, such as recovering a holy person's remains or toppling a tyrannical empire. The god might revoke a blessing if a character fails to pursue that purpose or acts counter to it. What's given can be taken away. A character retains the benefits of a blessing forever or until it is taken away by the god who granted it. Unlike a magic item, such a blessing can't be suppressed by an anti-magic field or similar effect. So that's super cool. You know, this is a magic that the player characters can have access to that will work in an anti-magic field or a dead magic zone, places like that, which is pretty awesome. Most adventurers go their entire lives without receiving even one of these blessings. There's no limit on the number of blessings a character can receive, but it should be rare for a character to have more than one at a time. Moreover, a character can't benefit from multiple instances of a blessing at the same time. For example, a character can't benefit from two instances of the blessing of health at once. So similar to attuned items, you can't have two of the same thing going on. So here are some examples. And we're also told that a typical blessing mimics the properties of a wondrous item. So we've got a few examples here, but keep in mind, you could take any wondrous item from the DMG or elsewhere and use that as inspiration for a blessing a god might bestow on a player character. So really, your options are almost endless. So here are some we're given here. Blessing of health increases constitution by 2 up to a max of 22. Blessing of protection plus 1 bonus to armor class and saving throws. Blessing of magic resistance, you have advantage on saves versus spells and other magical effects. Blessing of understanding plus 2 to wisdom up to a max of 22. Blessing of Valhalla. This blessing grants you the power to summon spirit warriors as if you had blown a silver horn of Valhalla. Once you use this blessing, you can't use it again until 7 days have passed. Blessing of weapon enhancement. One non-magical weapon in your possession becomes a plus 1 weapon whenever you wield it. Blessing of wound closure. This blessing grants you the benefits of a periapt of wound closure. And again, this is just the tip of the iceberg, because you can use any wondrous item as a springboard for a blessing that you want to create. So next we have charms, with which again, blessings are bestowed by a god or divine being of some kind. And a charm is bestowed by a powerful spirit, a location of ancient magic, or a creature with legendary action. So some magically powerful creature, like a fae or a dragon or a celestial or a demon, something like that. So a charm is a minor supernatural gift, which can be received in a large variety of ways. For instance, a wizard who finds an eldritch secret in a dead archmage's spellbook might be infused with the magic of a charm, as might a character who solves a sphinx's riddle or drinks from a magic fountain. Legendary creatures such as ancient gold dragons and unicorns sometimes grace their allies with charms, and some explorers find themselves bearing the magic of a charm after discovering a long-lost location that is drenched in primeval magic. Some charms can be used only once, and others can be used a specific number of times before vanishing. If a charm lets you cast a spell, you are able to do so without spending a spell slot or providing any components, verbal, somatic, or material. In any case, a charm cannot be used in an area created by an anti-magic field or a similar effect, and a charm's effects are susceptible to dispel magic and the like. But the charm itself can't be removed from a creature by anything short of divine intervention or the wish spell. So we have some example charms below. However, a typical charm mimics the effects of a potion or a spell. So you can easily come up with more charms of your own by just getting inspiration from potions and spells in the game and turning those into charms. So we have here the charm of animal conjuring, allows you to cast conjure animals as a third level spell, and you can use that one 3 times. Charm of dark vision lets you cast dark vision as an action, and that you can use 3 times. Charm of feather falling grants you the benefits of a ring of feather falling. These benefits last for 10 days. Charm of heroism gives you the benefit of a potion of heroism as an action, and it can only be used once. Charm of restoration has 6 charges, and you can use an action to spend some of its charges to cast either greater restoration, which takes 4 of the charges, or lesser restoration, which takes 2 charges. And then once you use all the charges, it's gone. Charm of the Slayer. One sword in your possession becomes a Dragon Slayer or Giant Slayer, DM's choice, for the next 9 days. Charm of Vitality. This charm allows you to give yourself the benefit of a potion of vitality as an action, and you can do that once. So yeah, you know, these are two rewards that I especially like, blessings and charms. And in Primordia, I see blessings coming from the deities a lot, and I see charms coming from Fae. I use Fae a lot in Primordia, so I see powerful Fae giving out charms. And yeah, a lot of fun. And also a way, you know, if your players are going to need a certain ability that they don't have access to, it's a way you can give them that ability, and a little more limited than a lot of magic items. You know, maybe you want them to have the ability for a certain point in the adventure, but you don't want them to have it forever. You don't want to give them a permanent magic item so they can do that thing forever. A charm or a blessing might be just what you're looking for. Another type of reward we have here are marks of prestige. So these can be things like letters of recommendation, could be a person of high reputation. So this could give the player characters access to NPCs they would otherwise have trouble meeting on their own, like a king or a queen or something like that. Also could be used to clear up, quote, misunderstandings they could get themselves into. So yeah, another reward they could receive is a medal of some kind. These are usually awarded by powerful political figures for acts of heroism, and wearing a medal is usually enough to earn the respect of those who understand its significance. So it says here that a medal doesn't offer a specific in-game benefit to one who wears it, but it can affect dealings with NPCs. So, you know, you could have that work different ways. You could give player characters advantage on roles to interact with NPCs that would be impressed by the medal, or you could just have the medal shift the NPC's reaction one step in the favorable direction, however you want to handle that. Another mark of prestige that could be received as a reward is a parcel of land. We talked about that a little bit last time, talking about downtime. So this is a way that player characters could get land that they could build a stronghold on. Another mark of prestige could be a special favor. Basically, a powerful NPC owes a favor to the player characters, and that could take all kinds of forms. There's also special rights. For instance, the ability to carry a weapon in town when that's normally not allowed, things like that, and strongholds. So in addition to a parcel of land, you could get one with an actual stronghold already on it, even better. And then titles, of course, you could get a title. And finally, our last idea for a reward here, a mark of prestige, is training. So the character can train with someone. Possible benefits of that could be gaining inspiration daily at dawn for 1d4 plus 6 days, or gaining proficiency in a skill, or gaining a feat. So our final type of reward that we're going to talk about today is epic boons. And this is a way, if you want to kind of, quote, go beyond 20th level in your game, this is a way you can do this. An epic boon is a special power available only to 20th level characters. Characters at that level gain such boons only if you want them to, and only when you feel it's appropriate. Epic boons are best awarded after the characters complete a major quest or accomplish something else particularly notable. A character might gain an epic boon after destroying an evil artifact, defeating an ancient dragon, or halting an incursion from the outer planes. Epic boons can also be used as a form of advancement, a way to provide greater power to characters who have no more levels to gain. With this approach, consider awarding one epic boon to each character for every 30,000 XP he or she earns above 355,000 XP. You, the GM, determine which epic boon a character gains. Ideally, the boon you pick is something the character would put to use in future adventures. You can allow a player to select a boon for his or her character, subject to your approval. Whatever boon a character ends up with, consider its place in your story and world. Many of the boons are extraordinary and represent the gradual transformation of a character into something resembling a demigod. The acquisition of a boon might visibly transform a character. For example, the eyes of a character with the boon of true sight might glow when he or she feels strong emotion, and a character who has the boon of high magic might have faint motes of light glimmering around his or her head. Also decide how the boon first appears. Does the boon appear spontaneously and mysteriously, or does a being of cosmic power manifest to bestow it? The bestowal of a boon can itself be an exciting scene in an adventure. All right, and we're given a few examples of epic boons here. Also, we have a little sidebar here, alternatives to epic boons. You might decide to grant one of the following rewards to a 20th level character instead of awarding an epic boon. These two options can be awarded to a character more than once. So you can give them an ability score improvement. The character can increase one ability score by 2 or increase 2 ability scores by 1 each. The maximum score can now be increased above 20 up to a maximum of 30. Or you can give them a new feat. The character gains a new feat chosen by the player but subject to your approval. So you can do one of those two when they, quote, gain a level above 20th, or you can give them one of these epic boons. All right. So I'm not going to go through all these, but just some of the things you get with these. With combat prowess, you can turn a melee weapon attack that misses into a hit instead. Dimensional travel, you can cast Misty Step spell. Boon of Fortitude, your hit point maximum increases by 40. Boon of High Magic, you gain 1 9th level spell slot, provided you already had one, so you get another one. Boon of Immortality, you stop aging. You're immune to any effect that would age you and can't die from old age. Invincibility, when you take a damage from any source, you can reduce that damage to 0. You can only use that once per short rest. Irresistible offense, you bypass the damage resistances of any enemy. Magic resistance, you have advantage on saves versus spells and other magical effects, and so on. Boon of True Sight, you have True Sight out to a range of 60 feet. So, you know, some of these are similar to one of the things you might get from gaining a level. Some of them just give you some kind of flat bonus or the ability to use some kind of spell or magical ability. Really cool stuff. So yeah, you know, epic boons are an option for you when you get to 20th level, or, you know, you can always give these out earlier too, if you wish. And there we did it. We got through chapter 7. Kind of a long episode today, but we got through it. Kind of went more quickly through some stuff than others. So as always, if there's something I kind of skimmed over that you'd like to hear more about, let me know. Shoot me an email, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 257 of Game Master's Journey. Hope you enjoyed our exploration of the treasure chapter of the DMG. And yeah, I really dig how in 5th edition, you know, we have these things like the blessings and the charms and the epic boons. Even going into the, you know, some of the more kind of in-world, less magic-y things you can get, like getting a stronghold or a piece of land, or a medal of honor or something like that. I feel like there's a lot that we can do with this stuff to flesh out the player characters, flesh out their place in the world, and to show the gratitude of the NPCs for the things that the player characters do for them. So if you have anything you'd like to share with me and the other listener GMs as far as how you use some of these things in your game, or maybe some cool new blessings or charms or epic boons that you've come up with, or a cool artifact or sentient item you've come up with, definitely let me know. I'd be happy to pass it on. And it's always fun to hear, you know, how these are used at. If you'd like to get a hold of me, a great way to do so is shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. I also have a voicemail you can call, 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391. And we also have communities on MeWe and Discord that you can join. And not only can you get a hold of me and ask me questions or tell me what's going on in your game, but you can also network with other listener GMs. And, you know, we've got a lot of smart and creative GMs that listen to this show and are very happy to give ideas and advice to other listener GMs who have questions or want to talk about their game. So definitely join us on our communities. You can find links to all those things in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. At the bottom of the show notes, you can find a link to our support page where you can find all the ways that you can help support this show and help keep me going. And definitely check out my D&D supplements I published, the latest of which is Relics of Power. And you can find all that stuff on the website at starwalkerstudios.com. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts. This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Tranceboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.